This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. We are a stop on Daniel Dresner's self-described Media Whore Week, promoting his new book, Theories of International Politics and Zombies. That's how he described his book tour on his blog. A few years ago, Dresner stumbled upon a paper that used zombies as a way to understand the threat of pathogens. That got him thinking about how theories of international relations might respond to an attack by the living dead, which he wrote about in Foreign Policy magazine. It got a huge response, and now his thoughts about foreign policy and the zombie canon have been published in a slim and very entertaining book. Daniel Dresner is a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's a senior editor at The National Interest, a contributing editor of Foreign Policy, where he has a daily blog. And Dan Dresner, welcome to Radio Times. The Media Whore Week continues, right?
This is the end of the Media Whore trip. So, yes, you know, I'm a little tired right now, but nevertheless, you know, full of vim and vigor.
Well, there you go. You know, I have to say, I read your book, and I can't decide whether you are poking fun, you know, at all the think tanks and the international theorists, or whether you really are worried about a zombie attack, or whether this is just a fun mental exercise that you might use in a classroom.
I think the answer is all of the above, actually. You know, when I started writing this, I had the idea, and the idea was that your average 18-year-old unfortunately knows a lot more about zombies than they do about international relations theory, and so this was a way in which they could actually learn about the theories. But as I started writing it, I actually hit a brick wall because it was too jokey initially. It was too sort of – the jokes were way too obvious. And in some ways, I'm very grateful. My editor at Princeton, Chuck Myers, basically said, you have to write this, and pardon the pun, in a deadpan manner.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I'll defend every piece of scholarship in that book. You know, every footnote is accurate. Every citation is correct. But that said, yes, it's obviously one of – as a result, it's funny because of the absurdity of it.
Now, have you been a longtime zombieophile?
No, I actually was not a longtime zombiephile. As I said in the acknowledgments, my exposure to the horror genre was initially my first. I watched Poltergeist when I was a kid, and it scared me like you wouldn't believe. And I did stop watching horror movies after that. It wasn't until I was an adult and I watched 28 Days Later, which is a wonderful movie, I would add.
I would agree. Danny Boyle.
Danny Boyle, exactly. That was the moment where I suddenly became a little more interested in zombies. But it was only once I decided to write the book that I actually watched all of Romero's movies, watched Shaun of the Dead, the Resident Evil franchise, and caught some more obscure zombie movies as well.
So what do you think zombies represent?
Well, zombies represent what, you know, former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld referred to as the unknown unknowns in world politics. So in some ways, zombies are the perfect protean 21st century threat, because depending upon how we think about them, whether we think they're smart or not, they could represent a threat like bioterrorism, or they could represent a threat like climate change or some kind of deadly pathogen. In some ways, that's why they actually turned out to be really great for the book, because depending upon the theory that you use, you interpret the zombies in a very different way.
Well, I want to play a clip, and this is from George Romero's cult classic. This goes back to 1968, Night of the Living Dead. And this is a scene, it's actually early in the movie. A character named Ben is boarding up the doors and the windows to the farmhouse he and others are hiding out in as he listens to a radio broadcast. I should add, this was filmed and set in rural Butler County, north of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Let's listen.
Because of the obvious threat to untold numbers of citizens, and because of the crisis which is even now developing, this radio station will remain on the air day and night. This station and hundreds of other radio and TV stations throughout this part of the country are pooling their resources through an emergency network hookup to keep you informed of all developments. At this hour, we repeat, these are the facts as we know them. There is an epidemic of mass murder being committed by a virtual army of unidentified assassins. The murders are taking place in villages, cities, rural homes, and suburbs with no apparent pattern or reason for the slayings. It seems to be a sudden, general explosion of mass homicide. We have some descriptions of the assassins. Eyewitnesses say they are ordinary-looking people. Some say they appear to be in a kind of...
And we'll leave those descriptions to your imagination. Again, a scene from Night of the Living Dead, the George Romero classic, I guess, that got everyone into this thinking about zombies.
Well, Romero, traditionally, zombies before Romero had been what you would consider the Haitian zombies. That's the other kind of category. These are the people who some voodoo witch doctor ostensibly puts them, you know, in a catatonic or dead state. Then they're resurrected. And these zombies are basically slaves to the witch doctor. What Romero did was basically basically combined that with cannibalism. He basically said these people are dead, then they rise up, they eat other people. And, of course, the one ironclad rule in any kind of zombie movie is that if you are bitten by a zombie, you inevitably become a zombie.
And you have some rules here. Zombies desire human flesh. They will not eat each other. They will not eat other zombies.
Right,
zombies,
because that's just gross.
Well, of course. And zombies cannot be killed unless their brain is destroyed. Mm-hmm. Any human being bitten by a zombie will inevitably become a zombie.
And that's, you know, if you compare that to sort of normal pathogens, like let's say the Ebola virus or AIDS, in some ways that's really scary. Even the most virulent actual viruses only have maybe a 50% infection rate. A 100% infection rate is a far more serious threat to humanity as we know it.
You know, listening to that scene from Night of the Living Dead, I'm reminded of War of the Worlds, when, again, radio broadcast about Martians, aliens, you know, coming and landing and scaring people to death.
I'm not going to lie. I mean, to do the research, I was doing a lot of catch-up, so I had to watch a lot of these movies back to back to back. And, of course, I had to watch them after my children were asleep because they were a little worried. I didn't want to scare them. So as a result, you know, you start watching movies like this every night at about 10 o'clock. You start getting a little creeped out.
Okay.
You know, I'd hear like little noises like, oh, God, it's the undead, you know. But fortunately, you know, the media whore tour has canceled that out. It's nice to see civilization as we know it continuing to thrive.
You had mentioned Donald Rumsfeld and his famous unknown unknowns as a way of thinking about zombies. So segueing from that to how a neoconservative or how neoconservative philosophy would view zombies.
Right.
How do they view the world? Perhaps we know because we have watched in Iraq.
Well, I think you have to give neoconservatives some credit on this, because neocons would probably be the first sort of group of theorists to recognize zombies as a truly existential threat to humanity. Neoconservatives would argue that zombies hate us for our freedoms, namely our freedom not to eat other people's brains. So, you know, they would obviously point out that what is required is an aggressive and militarized response, probably inserting, you know, troops with a heavy use of air power and a reliance on local allies in the heart of the zombie-infested territory. You know, relying obviously on things like the Revolution and Military Affairs to, quote, shock and awe the zombies into giving up, basically, and promoting a human uprising. The problem is that the neocons would not stop with the zombies.
Uh-huh.
The neocons would likely argue that the zombies had to have had help from the rest of America's enemies. So they would likely posit the existence of an axis of evil dead, which would include not just the zombies, but also China, Russia, Al-Qaeda, Iran, the United Nations, the European Union, Al Gore, you name it, they would all be part of the same axis of evil dead. That would likely undercut coalition warfare efforts considerably, and it would make it much more difficult to combat the undead. So in the end, you would probably have an extremely bloody insurgency on your hand as, you know, soldiers went native, so to speak, and you know, wound up becoming zombies. Maybe a massive surge in men and materiel might stem the tide, but in all likelihood, the costs would vastly exceed the benefits.
So are you saying the neocons would not be able to defeat the zombies?
They might defeat them, but you could argue that the cost of the action would be so prohibitively high that perhaps the best thing to do would be to try to contain the zombies rather than to completely eradicate them.
And is there a zombie movie that you think speaks to that international philosophy?
Actually, there is. It's not a great movie, but it's the only movie I've ever seen that is a perfect metaphor for the Iraq invasion, which was 28 Weeks Later, which is actually the sequel to 28 Days Later. In the sequel, there's a NATO force that comes back and reoccupies Great Britain after it's been washed away by the zombies, and shockingly, things go wrong.
Well, we do actually have a clip from 28 Days Later, and this is the movie we had mentioned earlier. It's the Danny Boyle movie. And just to set it up, you have a little chart here, very, very Spartan little chart here. Why speed does not causally affect the spread of zombies. The idea of a slow zombie and a fast zombie.
Right. This is a very fierce debate within the zombie studies community about whether or not zombies should be fast or slow. The traditional George Romero zombies were sort of, you know, slumbering walkers, whereas in 28 Days Later, these zombies run very fast. And so this has provoked a lot of debate within the zombie studies community. I'm arguing in the end it's irrelevant.
And this is a scene from Danny Boyle's movie 28 Days Later, where one survivor, Selena, is explaining what's happened to a character who just woke up from a coma to discover that England is overrun by fast-moving hordes of zombies. Let's listen.
He started his writing, and right from the beginning you knew this was different, because it was happening in small villages, market towns, and then it wasn't on the TV anymore. It was in the street outside. It was coming through your windows. It was a virus. An infection. You didn't need a doctor to tell you that. It was the blood. There was something in the blood. By the time they tried to evacuate the cities, it was already too late. The infection was everywhere. The army blockades were overrun. And that's when the extras started. The day before the TV and radio stopped broadcasting, there were reports of infection in Paris and New York. We didn't hear anything more after that.
What about the government? What are they doing?
There's no government.
Of course there's a government. There's always a government. They're in a bunker or a plane.
No, there's no government, no police, no army, no TV, no radio, no electricity. You're the first uninfected person we've seen in 6 days.
And again, a scene from 28 Days Later. That works on the radio, doesn't it?
It does, yes. It's a little scary. Again, that's a movie that's not actually happening.
Meaning?
I was just telling your listeners that was the case.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what do you do about the zombie denialists? I mean, they're always those people, that, especially in the world of, you know, politics or international politics, that say, you know, this doesn't exist. Global warming doesn't exist. There's no such thing as evolution. What's the response to a zombie denialist?
I think you basically have to cut and run. You've got to cut your losses there. Although I would argue, I got this question last night, that, you know, this is one of those examples where, in fact, you know, the Facebook and social networking revolution might actually kind of counter these sorts of denialists. Because if you could see on YouTube, you know, the dead rising from the grave and actually eating humans, maybe even those denialists would acknowledge that, you know, something weird is going on. So in some ways, I think zombies, unlike climate change, you know, climate change, you're talking about whether or not the Earth's temperature will rise by 1 or 2 degrees at all. On the other hand, with zombies, it's going to be pretty friggin' obvious if someone is actually eating your arm.
That's right. And zombies are all about eating the brain, right?
Well, this depends. You know, there was a movie called Return of the Living Dead in 1985. That's the one that popularized the notion of brains. Most other zombie movies, it's just about eating live human flesh. It doesn't necessarily have to be the brains. But, you know, brains is such a funny thing to say that, you know, it you have to go back to that constantly.
Well, and I should say that when I tried to do a promo for this show, I couldn't get through it because I kept laughing so hard that this notion of, you know, hordes of zombies sucking out people's brains.
Right. And as I said, that's, you know, the reason I wrote the book in part was that because I think learning these theories of international relations is really important, but teaching them in an extremely dry and abstract level, it's very tough to get that, you know, through the average undergrad. On the other hand, they know zombies.
Yes, they do. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Daniel Dresner is our guest. He's a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and he's written a new book. It's called Theories of International Politics and Zombies. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY, especially the zombieophiles in our audience. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about how neoconservatism, realism, liberalism would respond to the ultimate threat, zombie hordes overrunning our borders in their insatiable quest for human brains. And I mean this, that's what our guest Daniel Dresner writes about in his new book called Theories of International Politics and Zombies. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And again, I don't know how serious we are, how not serious we are, but I'm wondering about your booking agent, whether you got booked on a show that didn't get it, if you know what I mean.
I have to say I've been genuinely pleased with the I think the people who don't get it just don't book me. It would be the way to put it. So I've been genuinely impressed with the ways in which the media has actually understood what I'm going for. And furthermore, when I presented this initially, I was worried whether or not the students or the audience would get it. They've all gotten it really well.
And do you think people at all those pundit organizations, you know, do they get – I mean, are you sort of also tweaking fun at –
Maybe a little bit.
You know, people that get trotted on TV when there's a crisis, you know, then someone sit there and tell us what's going on.
Well, to be fair, I'm also tweaking my own profession. I'm tweaking academic study of international relations. I mean, in some ways, the book is actually structured the same way you would write a dissertation, which is there's a puzzle. The undead are here. Well, how do we define the undead? You've got to define terms. What does the literature say on this? You know, what would various theoretical predictions would be? How can we test these kinds of things? So as a result, you know, and it's written in a very clear, yeah, it's written in a clear style, I'd like to think, but it's also written in an academic style. And so when I've been presenting this, it's been very amusing because the undergraduates or general audience will often laugh at some things, but then the grad students and the professors will be rolling in the aisles because they'll know exactly, you know, who I'm punching when I talk about certain aspects of the book.
Well, let me play another George Romero film, and this is actually his second zombie movie going back to 1978. This is Dawn of the Dead. And this is a scene from the beginning of the film. A government scientist is being interviewed in a very chaotic TV news studio. It's actually in Philadelphia, about the response to a zombie invasion. Let's listen.
There is a martial law state in effect in Philadelphia, as in all other major cities in the country. Should we be unable to check the spread because of the emotional attitudes of the citizenry toward these issues of morality?
Jim, you take it.
It is the order of the OEP by command of the federal government. The prisons of the United States, citizens may no longer occupy private residences, no matter how safely protected or well stocked. Citizens will be moved into central areas of the city. The bodies of the dead will be delivered over to specially equipped squads of the National Guard for organized disposition.
And that's a scene from Dawn of the Dead. Now, what should we know about Dawn of the Dead?
Well, Dawn of the Dead, you can argue, is probably the greatest zombie movie ever made because there's everything in it. There's humor. There's a scene later in that movie where you actually have a biker gang attacking the zombies with, I swear to God, cream pies. You know, and also the bulk of the movie takes place in a shopping mall. And one of the things that Romero is obviously doing is sort of indicting what he thinks of as consumer culture of, in the United States. The other thing that's unusual about Dawn of the Dead is that it actually takes place as the zombies are really starting to make their inroads into humanity but haven't completely taken over yet. And that's unusual. One of the things about the zombie canon is that in most of these movies, you know, in the first minute the zombies appear and by minute 10 you're in a post-apocalyptic wasteland. And this was one of the things I came away relatively optimistic after writing this book, which is I actually think the zombie canon is too pessimistic about humanity.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that, you know, on the whole, to paraphrase Thucydides, you know, in the case of the zombies, the strong will do what they can, and unfortunately the weak must suffer being devoured by ravenous reanimated corpses.
Well, what I interested me is it's obviously set in this TV studio, and when right. There are crises, you know, we all, most of us anyway, turn to the TV sets and the anchors to tell us what is going on, what are we supposed to do, you know, who are we supposed to be afraid of?
That's always been a staple of zombie movies, regardless. You know, you always see people clustered around the television or listening to the radio. Although, interestingly enough, George Romero in 2007 or 8, I want to say, made a movie called Diary of the Dead, which sort of rebooted the franchise, where in his case what he was interested in was sort of YouTube and more social network technology. So instead of, you know, being huddled around the TV screen, they're huddled around their computer looking at all these videos being uploaded.
And we should say Romero was or lived a lot in Pennsylvania. We heard the Philadelphia reference in that last one.
Yeah, he grew up and well, he didn't grow up. His first job was in Pittsburgh. He actually worked for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Unbelievable.
And then decided to make a movie with his friends. So yeah, Pennsylvania has a very, very prominent and important role in the zombie canon.
Well, let me kind of segue between the zombie canon, as you say, and also some of these theories of international politics.
Sure.
Realpolitik would be right. One example of that. First of all, when we say that, who do you think of when you think of realpolitik?
Well, probably the person most prominently known to everyone else would be Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger is always thought of as your realpolitik. A lot of people in the first Bush administration, like Brent Scowcroft, would also generally be thought of as realists. And in the academic world, people like Ken Waltz or John Mearsheimer. Now, realists, you know, would respond when asked, you know, what would happen if the dead were to rise from the grave, would say, well, you know, the world wouldn't change that much. Which might sound shocking, except you have to realize that realists give that answer to everything. You know, realists have generally argued that the laws of international politics have been unchanging since the time of Thucydides. So, you know, the undead, that's not really anything new. They would just argue again that the great powers would likely exploit these instances of the undead to probably advance their own narrow interests. So China, for example, would likely claim that there was a major zombie infestation on Taiwan and therefore have to dispatch troops in order to deal with it. Russia would likely do the same thing with Belarus. And there's probably a better than 50-50 shot that the United States would have to send the 82nd Airborne to Cuba, arguing there was a zombie infestation there. So the great powers would exploit the kind of chaos and advance their own interests. And because they would do that, realists would be profoundly skeptical that there would actually be a global war on zombies, that the likelihood of great power cooperation would be pretty low.
So who would win in that war between the realpolitik believers or thinkers and zombies?
Well, I think they would argue that, according to realists, what would happen is that the great powers would, you know, stay. There would be fortress humanity within the great powers. The developing world would, frankly, be a little screwed.
Because they're the developed. I mean,
because they're too weak.
Because we don't care about them, right?
Right. And also, they lack their own. They lack the capacity. They lack the military capabilities and the infrastructure to be able to combat the zombies. So there would be large swaths of the world that would likely be overrun by the undead.
And I don't think I've ever heard Henry Kissinger and the word zombie in the same sentence together.
It works better than you think.
Let me reintroduce you, Dan Dresner.
Friends.
Yeah, there we go. Dan Dresner, our guest professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's also a senior editor at The National Interest, a contributing editor at Foreign Policy, where he also has a daily blog. And he's the author of this book that we've been talking about called Theories of International Politics and Zombies. And I should give a shout out to the University of Princeton Press for publishing this book. Let me get some calls in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Then we'll go back to some more zombie clips. We have Jeff from, looks like, Galloway Township joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, I love the show.
Thank you.
A topic near and dear to my heart. I got to point out, though, I think you're doing a little bit of a blurring the lines a little bit, trying to group the zombies that are in the Dead franchise with 28 Days Later, when in fact the guys from 28 Days Later are merely infected with a germ warfare weapon, I believe, and the other ones are attacked by
actually dead
serious rays from outer space.
There you go.
That's true.
No. Oh my God, they're getting in the car. Help me.
I was waiting for that as well. Well, you got called out on your zombie information. Right?
I was afraid that might happen. I mean, all I can say is technically he's correct because the infected in 28 Days Later are in theory alive. That said, they pretty much act like zombies. And the zombie genre, I think, has embraced these movies as an example of the zombie canon. And furthermore, you can argue 28 Days Later is actually responsible for the revival in zombie movies. Between one-third and one-half of all zombie movies have been made in the last 10 years.
Is that right?
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of possible explanations for this. One is that it was 9/11, that zombie movies actually start to spike during periods of economic or security uncertainty. Another thing, you know, somewhat more mundane would be that both 28 Days Later and the first Resident Evil movie came out in 2002, and they both did relatively well at the box office.
Mm. So you're not a zombie absolutist, perhaps our caller was?
I've long feared this question of, you know, well, you know, aren't you accurately depicting the zombies? I'm comfortable, you know, keeping the 28 Days Later zombies into the canon. And furthermore, I would argue that, you know, any actual theory of social science that can explain more phenomenon is usually thought of as a better theory. So if I can explain both, you know, your typical Romero zombies and your Danny Boyle fast, you know, infected kind of guys, then I think it's a better theory.
Good try, Jeff. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me get Dave from Abington to join our conversation. And Dave, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I appreciate your show.
Thanks.
I became a zombie lover recently, and I never even knew what the attraction was. But I had seen lots of social commentary in the zombie movies, and particularly, and I think it was Survival of the Dead, when I think that was the Romero movie, where the dead become more conscious and start,
actually,
I guess, more aggressively and thoughtfully going after the humans.
I think you're thinking of Land of the Dead, actually.
Land of the Dead, Dave?
Yeah, Land of the Dead.
But I thought it was interesting that the leader of the zombies was a gasoline station attendant in bib overalls. And it seems as if, you know, certainly the notion that the weak may have died in the social Darwinistic theory, that the weak will die, but they're not really dead, that they're kind of come back for some justice one way or the other. And I thought that was a real powerful, interesting twist. So you can enjoy zombie movies because they're horror flicks, or you can dig around for some social commentary.
Sure.
And well, I just love that about these movies.
Well, I appreciate the call, Dave. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, first of all, it's absolutely true. One of the reasons why I think the zombie genre is popular among, you know, political scientists is, in fact, because it's a genre that allows you to play with ideas in a way, in a sort of kind of roundabout way, rather than just doing straight drama, which might be somewhat more boring. Land of the Dead, which is you're referring to, is in some ways, I think, Romero's probably most Marxist film, for lack of a better way of putting it, where it's very clear he sort of sympathizes much more with the zombies in that movie than he does with the humans. And I do have a footnote in the book saying I didn't tackle the Marxist theory of international relations because I am writing this from an explicitly pro-human perspective. And my fear is that Marxists would, in fact, sympathize with the zombies, that the zombies for them would represent the sort of proletariat overthrowing their human bourgeoisie. So in that sense, I do want more humans out there rather than zombies. So I think there's got to be better ways to reform the system.
Well, what about liberals? I mean, wouldn't they have a more sort of humane view of zombies?
Well, no, not necessarily. Liberals would probably argue that, killing the undead is, in fact, a major public good. On the whole, we're probably better off, operating as humans rather than zombies. So they would project the creation of a global counter-zombie regime, nay, even perhaps a world zombie organization to tackle this. However, liberals would acknowledge that there would probably be elements of global civil society that would, in fact, advocate for undead rights. We're talking about groups that would emerge like Zombies Without Borders, Zombie Rights Watch, Zombaid, People for the Ethical Treatment of Zombies. All of these groups would likely, argue that perhaps we should treat the zombies in a somewhat different manner. But, this depends on the kind of zombie because, by and large, you can't really bargain with the zombies. I mean, there's a great song by Jonathan Colton that sort of articulates the zombie bargaining position, and it's pretty implacable.
Well, in fact, we have that song ready to go. This is Jonathan Colton's song. It's called R.E., Your Brains. It goes back to 2006. And in the song, he captures some of the delicate negotiations and inter-office politics of dealing with a former coworker when that coworker is now a brain-eating zombie. Let's listen.
Hey, Tom, it's Bob from the office down the hall. It's good to see you, buddy. How have you been? Things have been okay for me, except that I'm a zombie now. I really wish you'd let us in. I think I speak for all of us. I say I understand why you folks might hesitate to submit to our demand. But here's an FYI, you're all gonna die screaming. All we wanna do is eat your brains. We're not unreasonable, I mean no one's gonna eat your eyes. If you open up the door, we'll all come inside and eat your brain. I don't want to nitpick, Tom, but is this really your plan? Spend your whole life locked inside a mall. Maybe that's okay for now, but someday you'll be out of guns, and you'll have to make the call. I'm not surprised to see you haven't thought it through enough. You never had the head for all that bigger picture stuff. But Tom, that's what I do, and I plan on eating you slowly.
That's Jonathan Colton's 2006 song called R.E., your brains and maybe a new Radio Times theme music. I'm not sure. But it's very clever.
And it demonstrates, you know, if the zombie bargaining position is that their position is, oh, sure, we'll be reasonable. We just won't eat your eyes. You know, surely we can compromise and we will eat your brains. Well, you know, then liberals are stymied in that sense because they can't. It's a zero-sum bargaining situation with the zombies. Where liberals might actually be useful, however, is in arguing that the humans are more likely to cooperate with each other in trying to combat the undead menace. So in that sense, liberals are probably more confident that there would be a global war on zombies than realists would be, for example.
But they would have to come together.
Yes.
As a coalition, essentially. I mean, maybe put aside...
Well, this is actually really popular in the romantic zombie comedy genre, or rom-zom-com, as it's commonly known. There was a great movie called Shaun of the Dead, where, in fact, similarly, it's a similar situation to the original Night of the Living Dead, where you've got a few people trapped, I believe, in a pub rather than a farmhouse. And yet what happens there, it plays out in a much more liberal way rather than a realist way.
So who are the zombies now, as you have spent time thinking about watching all these movies? I mean, are there certain people that you think are zombies?
You know, I don't want to speculate, although I will know, I don't know if you saw this, there was an article earlier this week about how the New York State Bar Association has already come out with an emergency plan in case there is quote-unquote radiological or quote-unquote chemical outbreaks. I mean, I think that's code for the undead, frankly. So,
oh, do you?
Yeah. I have no doubt that the great power governments are already working on contingency plans. When looking at individual people and speculating whether they're zombies, I don't want to cast aspersions. All I will say is Sarah Palin seems awfully fond of quote-unquote moose. Have we ever actually seen her eat that, or is she eating something else? I just want to know.
So you just let that sort of hang out there and let people digest it?
I'm not making any actual claims. I just, you know, I will ask people to use their brains before the zombies use them instead.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Actually, we're going to play a clip from that rom-zom-com, Shaun of the Dead. And our guest today on Radio Times has written a book called called Theories of International Politics and Zombies. His name is Daniel Dresner, and he's a professor at Tufts University. And we'll take some more calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We don't get too many guests on the show who are affiliated with both the Council on Foreign Relations and the Zombie Research Society, but our guest, Daniel Dresner, is. He's a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and we've been talking about his new book called Theories of International Politics and Zombies. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And our guest mentioned the Shaun of the Dead, a 2004 romantic zombie comedy, or rom-zom-com, by Edgar Wright. And this is Shaun, played by Simon Pegg, and he's rallying the survivors at the Winchester pub with the words of the British philosopher Bertrand Russell, which Shaun had found written on a beer coaster. Let's listen.
Okay, has anyone fired a gun before?
Oh, yeah.
Apart from Ed.
I'm a pacifist.
Apart from David and Ed.
Sorry, what was Ed's experience?
He shot his sister in the leg with an air rifle.
I think you should do it.
I think we should all do it.
Who can five people operate one gun?
None of us have any real experience, okay? Now, we've only got 29 bullets.
Call them shells.
We've only got 29 shells. We really need to work together on this. I need someone to help me reload, everyone else to look out. I will fire. As Bertrand Russell once said, the only thing that will redeem mankind is cooperation. I think we can all appreciate the relevance of that now.
Was that an awful beer, Matt?
Yeah, it was Guinness Extra Cold.
I won't say anything.
Thanks.
Would anyone want to come in?
Oh, I know someone who thinks Shaun of the Dead was the best movie that's ever been made in the history of movies.
It is an extremely good film. And I have to admit, as I was doing the research for this book, when I had watched it before, but I had forgotten that scene, and I saw, you know, him quoting Russell, I thought, I now know this book will work.
Yeah. When you quote Bertrand Russell and you're talking about, you know, gun...
The only thing that will save mankind is cooperation. That is your classic liberal paradigm at work.
There you go. Let me get, looks like Yanni Bar from West Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And go ahead, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi. Let me preface what I'm going to say. But as a teenager, I was a huge fan of horror movies.
So I've seen all the classics you mentioned, although I haven't seen the Shaun of the Dead. But I think I find their recent popularity quite repugnant in the current economic crisis, because I think that the poor, the zombies really are a metaphor for the poor in this situation, mm-hmm. and that there are all these people out there. You cannot help them, but and you shouldn't try, because they might kill you. And I think if you see it that way, it's really a, you know, take care of yourself, take care of your own, but don't try to help everybody. So I don't think that's a good, unlike the classics, who had some social, some social goodness, they had it to say. I think the recent surge is more of a fear response to the current climate.
Well, that's interesting. I'd be interested in that. That from his perspective, he says, you know, zombies represent poor people, and mm-hmm. we shouldn't care about poor people.
Well, there's always been concern about the zombie genre. George Romero himself argued that during the 90s, before the movies were popular, it was actually video games, Left 4 Dead, for example, and others. And he's argued that one of the reasons that zombie movies are popular is because it allows you to kill a human-like entity without feeling any remorse or guilt. So there's certainly that kind of issue there. That said, I do think most of the zombie movies that have been made, even the more recent ones, are somewhat sympathetic. You know, they do have a social purpose. Maybe not the social purpose that the caller wants, which is wealth redistribution or what have you. But, for
sure.
example, Land of the Dead is about as sympathetic for the zombies as you possibly can be, really unsympathetic to humans. And, in fact, that's actually one of the major tropes in the canon, is that most of the movies about zombies are far more pessimistic about the ability of humans to adapt than they are about the zombies' ability to adapt.
So it's a cautionary tale for humans?
It's always a cautionary tale that, you know, unless human beings cooperate, well, you know, you're in the post-apocalyptic wasteland.
Jan de Bar, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Now, Dan, in this book you have a picture and two people playing video games.
Yes.
And it says the lifestyles of the college student and the zombie are eerily similar.
Well, my point here is that, and this is in the chapter on social constructivism, which is probably the most, you know, arcane theory for your listeners, but social constructivism argues that basically what really matter are norms in world politics, that there are certain, you know, aspects of right and wrong that matter. So, for example, 300 years ago, slavery was a really popular concept in the global political economy. Now it would be taboo. It would be horrible to be exposed to that. So there are certain norms that people either embrace or reject. Constructivists would argue that if, in fact, the undead were to emerge, the way to respond to them would actually be to socialize them into human norms, to make them think eating people is bad. And if you get the zombies to embrace those norms, then really they cease being a threat if they recognize that. Of course, the problem with this argument is that human beings are also susceptible to zombie norms. If you have enough zombies out there, there's what's called a norm cascade, and eventually human beings will start pretending to be like zombies just in order to fit in. Now, if you have a world where there are both zombie norms and human norms out there, which norms would triumph? Now, you would think, well, surely you don't want to eat people, so the human right. norms would win. But there are aspects of the zombie lifestyle that are very attractive. You know, zombies don't discriminate. They'll eat anyone, regardless of race, gender, sexual preference, religion, what have you. They're really big on casual wear, and they're extremely eco-friendly. You know, they walk everywhere, and they only eat local organic produce. So as a result, you know, if you think about it, these are the kinds of tropes that are similar to the change agents in current American society, which is, say, college students. So if college students were to start to embrace the zombie lifestyle, and God knows we're seeing a lot of, you know,
haven't they already?
Well, you can argue that college students have already dressed up like zombies. You know,
they hang out in packs, as you say.
They have human versus zombie events on campus, you know. So, you know, it might be the case that the zombie norms would actually be more powerful than, you know, people of our generation might initially think.
I'm glad you think you and I are in the same generation. But let me get Eric from King of Prussia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Eric. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Long-time listener. Great show.
Thank you.
I just want to actually reference, I'm on the road, and I'm going to stop at the Borders Books and pick up your book as soon as I get done work.
But Eric, you're a wise man.
I wanted to stop and reference Max Brooks from World War Z and get your commentary, at least on the dichotomy that he put up as, in one example, at one point, during the outbreak, the Israelites and the Palestinians actually got together and were protecting their people, and they locked down the state of Israel and in a communion, and it was like the best defended. And then on the other side of the coin, as the refugees were fleeing from Pakistan, mm-hmm. trying to get into Iran, Iran actually nukes the passes between them to try and stop that to stop the refugees from bringing in the infection. And then the very last point is they go out to find this guy that came up with a plan to deal with rebellions during apartheid. Mm-hmm. And it basically comes down to they go and grab every particular socialite or valuable person to society, and then, much like in Jersey, where only the strong survive and the weak are eaten, the weak are left behind to kind of distract the zombies.
Well, Eric, let me get a response from our guest.
Well, first of all, let me. Eric is giving a shout out to, I think, the only book I really do recommend to even people who don't like zombies. It's a book by Max Brooks called World War Z. And it's written in sort of Studs Terkel style. It's an oral history of the war 10 years after it takes place. Max Brooks is incidentally the son of Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft, actually. But it's a really extremely well-done book, and I strongly recommend it. Now, what he's referring to is that there were, you know, the ways in which different parts of the world respond to the zombie outbreak is very different. Israel, which has a relatively strong state, I mean, it's got robust capabilities, was very good at early detection and setting up a quarantine procedure whereby people who came in, they had sniffer dogs to detect whether or not these people were infected or not. So therefore, Israel, you know, retained a relatively clean, human-only state. Whereas Pakistan, which is, you know, everyone acknowledges is a weak and failing government in a lot of ways, in the end completely disintegrates and there winds up being, you know, conflict with Iran and so forth. So in some ways, this is further evidence that, in fact, states with relatively robust capabilities, you know, both in terms of firepower but also intelligence and adaptability, are probably going to be well prepared in case of the zombie apocalypse. Failing states, weak states, not so much.
Eric, thanks for calling into Radio Time. So have you thought about what would happen if Tufts University got attacked by zombies?
Well, we're
are you ready for that?
We're located on a hill, and you know, we're in a building that has a lot of floors. And is, you know, based on my close observation, zombies don't climb terribly well, actually.
Oh.
So, you know, if the United States stops hearing from me for a week, that's an indication that I've gone to New Zealand. New Zealand is my preferred zombie redoubt. Because New Zealand is relatively remote. It's got a lot of mountains that are really hard to scale and really some lovely wines.
And do zombies swim?
This is a point of some contention. There are different questions about this within the zombie canon. You know, in the movie Land of the Dead and in World War Z, the stopping power of water does not affect zombies. Zombies can go underwater because, you know, if you think about it, they don't need to breathe. So why would water deter them? On the other hand, in 28 days later, water does seem to actually pose a small problem for the zombies. So in part, this depends on the kind of zombie that would emerge. But I think even the 28 days later kind of zombies would eventually probably figure out how to master the water.
Let me play one more clip that we pulled out. And this is buried away in the DVD extras that accompany Zack Snyder's remake of Dawn of the Dead are a series of fake news reports documenting a zombie outbreak, and they include this White House statement from the press secretary. Let's listen to that.
The president wants to make it perfectly clear that this is not a case of bioterrorism. No such agents exist in the arsenal of any nation or known terrorist group. He also wants to stress the need for calm and respect for law and order. The quicker people can get off the streets and into their homes, the quicker the appropriate federal and state agencies can reach these troubled areas. Although a further call-up of reservists is on the table, our current overseas military assets will remain in place to reassure our allies that this is a minor, containable situation that we expect to see fully resolved in 24 hours or less.
So what's your I feel like I've heard that before. What's your response to that?
Well, this actually talks about and I've got chapters in the book on both domestic politics and bureaucratic politics, and this reveals a sort of interesting dynamic there. On the one hand, you know, during times of crisis, there is a tendency called the rally around the flag effect, which is in a time of crisis, your natural instinct is to support your government thinking they're going to do the right thing. And the problem, of course, is that the government naturally would likely issue a statement of calm saying we have the situation under control. No need to panic. And we know from bureaucratic politics that that's probably not going to be the case. Bureaucratic politics is all about standard operating procedures. It's all about developing routines for dealing with what's expected. And I think it would be safe to say that the zombies would be an unexpected occurrence. So in all likelihood, the first bureaucratic responses to the zombies would likely be strewn with error and lead to catastrophe. Now, I am somewhat confident that these bureaucracies would eventually figure out how to do this. The problem is by that point, trust in government is going to evaporate because their initial claims of calm are obviously going to be belied by people getting eaten on the streets. So I think one of the paradoxes is that there'll be support for the government when they were likely to screw up. But once the government learns what to do, the public will cease to trust them. And that goes back to the clip you played earlier from Dawn of the Dead, from the first Dawn of the Dead,
right,
showing that, you know, that's likely when government efforts are more likely to be sabotaged. So it's an unfortunate paradox there.
Let me throw something else out. And this is a psychological, I guess, idea, confirmation bias. It's one of my favorite ones, which is, and I think we see it at work, which is that we essentially seek out information that reinforces what we believe in.
Right.
And that's how people end up watching, you know, MSNBC or Fox or something
right.
like that. Now, taking confirmation bias, how would that then respond to a zombie invasion?
Well, obviously,
what role would it play?
Well, in that sense, what confirmation bias would likely do is, you know, cause people to determine, you know, in advance who is likely to be infected. And, you know, what's going on. So, as you said, the zombie denialists are probably
yes.
going to be likely to be more likely to sort of bunker down cognitively and refuse to recognize reality unless they were to actually see it in front of their face. Similarly, those who want to combat the zombies might actually be overly aggressive in terms of responding to the zombies. Actually, in terms of the individual psychology thing, the part that I was really happy with, and I actually did a real survey on this, is an idea called prospect theory, which is the notion that compared to the status quo, people are risk-averse when operating in a world of gains, which means they're more likely to take the sure thing if they know they're going to get a benefit from it. But if they're faced in a world of losses, they're more likely to be risk-loving. And so I conducted a survey saying, you know, would you prefer to guaranteed kill 500 zombies or a 50% shot of killing 1,000 zombies or 100 zombies? And most people took the sure thing. But then when you flip the question around saying, the zombies are growing, would you prefer an option that you know, guarantees the creation of 500 more zombies or a risky option that, you know, maybe only 100 zombies will be created or 1,000 zombies? They all took the risky option.
Huh.
So prospect theory applies to the undead as well as conventional international relations.
So are you enjoying your 15 minutes of fame, or maybe this is in a half an hour of fame for
this
you?
This has been the best media whore tour ever.
And you've written other books, right?
Yes, that's true.
All politics is global.
Yes, the sanctions paradox and U.S. trade strategy. I'm a full professor, so you can really only write this kind of book and still maintain a role in the academy once you're at that level. And I have to say, I think one of the pleasures of this book for me was that I knew this was going to be a hit because my father thought it was a bad idea. And my father has often been a very good anti-predictor of things I should do in my career. And so when he thought this was a bad idea, I was like, okay, I know I'm hitting gold
right.
with this.
And it's interesting to be an anti-predictor.
Yes, yes.
So long, there's a certain kind of skill involved.
It's still useful,
in that, isn't it?
Though. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's someone who gets
it's
everything.
Like opposite day. Right,
right, exactly. And to be fair, he's right about a lot of things, just not necessarily about my career.
So when you were a graduate student, did you think, gosh, you know, one day I'm going to be this expert in zombies and international relations?
Let me put it this way. On March 1st, I'm actually going to be doing a reading at the Harvard Coop bookstore of this book, and it's going to be covered by C-SPAN, Book
kidding.
TV. No, I'm not. And, you know, I mean, this was one of those things I'd always dreamed about as a grad student. I will write a book that will cause people, you know, that television will cover. I don't think I would have thought it was about zombies. That's just a bonus, frankly.
Well, it's been so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us today
Thank
on Radio
you.
Times. And Dan Dresner has been our guest. He's a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's a senior editor at the National Interest and a contributing editor at Foreign Policy, where he writes a daily blog, and we've been talking about his new book called Theories of International Politics and Zombies. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. Check us out on Facebook. Send us an email. There's Twitter. There are all those archives as well. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the Radio Times interns are Will Stone and Rachel Bai. The show was produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media.